Did you see the atrocious results this week comparing our school kids' performances internationally? It was for reading, maths and literacy in general. We were very much below average. Well, the Science Show has a remedy, and it comes from 1963, close to 50 years ago, when the world heard this.
Oh, I had a terrible day. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, what's the trouble?
Oh, it's one of the girls, Susan Foreman.
Susan Foreman? She your problem too?
Yes.
And you don't know what to make of her?
No.
How old is she, Barbara?
15.
15. She lets her knowledge out a bit at a time so as not to embarrass me. She knows more science than I'll ever know. She's a genius. Is that what she's doing with history?
Something like that.
So your problem is whether to stay in business or hand over the class to her?
No, not quite.
What then?
Ian, I must talk to someone about this, but I don't want to get the girl into trouble. And I know you're going to tell me I'm imagining things.
Oh, I'm not.
Well, I told you how good she is at history. Mm. I had a talk with her and I told her she ought to specialize. Well, she seemed quite interested till I said I'd be willing to work with her at her home. Then she said that would be absolutely impossible as her grandfather didn't like strangers.
He's a doctor, isn't he? It's a bit of a lame excuse.
Well, I didn't pursue the point, but then recently her homework's been so bad.
Yes, I know.
Finally, I was so irritated with all her excuses, I decided to have a talk with this grandfather of hers and tell him to take some interest in her.
Oh, did you indeed? And what's the old boy like?
Well, that's just it. I got her address from the secretary, 76 Totters Lane, and I went along there one evening. Well, there isn't anything there. It's just an old junkyard.
Well, you must have gone to the wrong place.
Well, that was the address the secretary gave me.
Well, the secretary got it wrong then.
No, I checked. There's a big wall on one side, houses on the other, and nothing in the middle. And this nothing in the middle is number 76 Totters Lane.
That's a bit of a mystery. Well, there must be a simple answer somewhere.
Well, what?
Well, we'll have to find out for ourselves, won't we?
Thank you for the we.
So, who was Susan's elusive grandfather 50 years ago? Any ideas? The doctor. He emerged on our televisions at least 50 years ago. But what was he a doctor of and where did he get his doctorate? We shall reveal all in this Science Show number 1891. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. We shall also, and is this a coincidence, note the 750th anniversary in 2013 of Balliol College, probably the oldest in the English-speaking world. Echidnas are pretty old too, and this week a paper in the journal Science shows how these monotremes, not quite mammals, have both parents, the father and the mother, influence growth of the fetus. Ways that became vital in placental mammals. Bryony Forbes and Frank Grutzner are at the University of Adelaide. Now, these animals are, of course, sort of proto-mammals. They're monotremes, which means they do suckle their young, but they lay eggs. How much commitment is there, Frank, of the mother towards the offspring?
I think there's still a huge investment. If you just look at the egg itself, it's packed with nutrients. And also if you look at the ovary, they're huge. So obviously there is a lot of investment from the mother. And then once the offspring is born, then they will lactate and they will support their young. And probably that even more is an enormous energy expense on the mother's side.
Does the father turn up in any way?
The father turns up during breeding season and probably tries to fertilize as many females as he possibly can.
That says toodaloo.
That's it.
I see. Now, when it comes to energy, you've been, Barney, looking at some aspects of that. What really is the difference between the male and the female in that regard?
So the growth factor itself that is controlling the growth of the fetus is expressed by the mother, but the control of that gene is also impacted by the father's genes.
Well, obviously, you've got two sets of genes, and so it's a kind of orchestral play between them.
Yes, so growth factor that's driving the fetal growth is expressed under the control of the paternal, the father's side, whereas the recognition of that growth factor and its ability to work is driven from the mother's side. So there's this balance between father and mother controlling the ability for the fetus to grow.
I would have thought that that would be the same in all of us, isn't it?
There's quite a fundamental difference, because a lot of the growth in the egg-laying mammals, that would be for birds and reptiles, the nutrients are put into the egg, and that will be the same for all of them. So the father can't really do much about it. But in the placental mammals, in us, of course, to a very extensive period of time, the growth is happening within the mother. And that's where the paternal genes are believed to really do something to basically ensure their survival. And that's where this fundamental evolutionary theory claims that the father's genes are basically promoting the growth of the embryo in the uterus, trying to extract as much energy as possible from the mother, while the mother is trying to preserve energy for future offspring that will be her offspring. And I think what we've done in this work is identified possibly the first step for two important genes in this growth regulation, and how change in these genes and their binding affinities have probably really set these genes up to become part of that conflict between paternal and maternal genes.
So what you're saying is the monotremes are more than just primitive sort of mammals. They are specialist mammals in the sort of way that we are as well.
That's true, but they aren't as fully developed, I guess is a way of putting it, represent a intermediate stage between non-mammalian species and fully functional mammals as we are as humans. So they're an intermediate step.
How difficult was it to get the biochemical part of this stuff worked out?
This used the expertise of our colleagues in Oxford, and they've done a lot of work in determining protein structures from a lot of species, from birds right through to echidna, platypus, opossum and humans. And that took a lot of work, many years of effort to understand the fine molecular detail that drives the interaction between the growth factor and its receptor.
Of course, it's quite amazing when you think about it. The mammals with the placentas, there you've got this alien creature growing up inside you with different genes. You know, it's got the paternal genes, got some of yours, but, you know, 50% more or less of someone else's. And your body's got to try to cope with that and not reject it, not be overwhelmed by it. It's a pretty amazing process, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think so many things are happening, of course, during a pregnancy. And as you said, there's all these challenges of basically having a foreign implant in your body and all the adjustments that have to be made. And then on the other hand, what we said before is this enormous energy investment into the growth of the embryo. But I think that the cost obviously has been worth it. And as we can see, I think the having extensive development in the womb, of course, comes with fantastic benefits. You're independent from your environment. And so it has, of course, been extremely important for mammalian development, for the success also in the humans. And a lot of adjustments had to be made. And I think that's what we're trying to break that down to the steps that has really helped us, I think, achieve that during evolution.
The beginnings of full parental involvement and how both father and mother influence growth of the fetus, published in the journal Science this week. Associate Professors Bryony Forbes and Frank Grutzner at the School of Molecular and Biomedical Science, University of Adelaide, with a little help from Oxford, where we leap to now, investigating flesh-eating bacteria and another breakthrough involving genes and the structure of proteins. This is biochemist Mark Howarth. Now, tell me, what is a flesh-eating bacterium? What does it actually do to eat flesh?
There are a number of different species of bacteria which are able to cause this horrific disease termed necrotizing fasciitis, where the bacterium can cause loss of large amounts of tissue. And the way it does this is through secreting enzymes which break down the connective tissue, and it also stimulates the immune system. And the immune system, rather than helping clear the infection, actually contributes to the damage. So you can get very severe tissue degeneration. And unfortunately, in many cases, the surgeons can remove the infected area, but sometimes it's so bad that amputation is the most effective treatment to actually avoid death.
So the flesh is almost dissolving.
It's quite horrific.
And does it occur quite commonly, this affliction?
It's not especially common. There was a period of hysteria in Britain in the 90s about this disease. It turned out that a lot of this was media-driven. The number of cases that were found during that year were similar to the number of cases in previous years. But one of the strange things is that the origin is not very clear, that this bacterium, many people are carriers of it, and what happens to cause this condition is not clear. It's not like there's a particular strain which necessarily leads to it in every case.
Your work reminded me of looking for, if you like, the Higgs boson of microbiology. Looking at how the glue works, just as the Higgs boson provides mass and to some extent binds small particles together. So similarly, what you're looking at is the way that small creatures manage to somehow coalesce and have the glue within their systems.
Yeah, that's a very interesting analogy. I hadn't thought of it like that. I mean, the Higgs boson is universal and relates to all matter. The features that we study are actually not at all universal, and that's why people have only discovered it in the last few years. They're very specific to a certain class of bacteria, and within those bacteria, only a small proportion of the proteins actually contain this specific, what we might call a glue. But they're quite interesting because many of those bacteria are responsible for some very serious conditions, like the flesh-eating diseases we discussed, but also the Staphylococcus aureus also has this glue within its proteins, and the causative agent of diphtheria, for example. So we can take this particular feature and apply it in new circumstances and create a kind of a glue that hasn't been seen before and apply it for mammalian systems.
So what they're trying to do, is this right, is to latch on to parts of the body from which our general system is trying to expel them. So if they're rushing through the pipes, they're trying to hang on and stay in the system. Is that right?
Yes, that's a part of it. So they're sending out these anchors which enabled them to latch on, and attaching to the lining of your throat is one of the first crucial steps in the infection cycle. And it's important that they can produce very strong, stable anchors. And the way they do this is quite different to the way that most organisms produce strong protein structures. And part of this may relate to the fact that many of these bacteria survive very well under very low oxygen environments. And if you have oxygen around, there's certain oxidizing chemistry which you're able to do to lock your proteins together, which these bacteria are unable to do. And so evolution has managed to come up with an alternative chemistry, an alternative glue to hold these proteins together.
And how are you making use of that?
What we've done is dissect these proteins. So rather than one half of the bacterium's protein sticking to the other half and the protein becomes locked together, what we've done is split this protein into two parts. We can do this genetically, so that when the two parts come together, then they form an irreversible lock. There's nothing you can do to break this linkage, which is quite different to the way that most interactions work in biology, where things are tuned to be easy to put together, easy to pull apart, because things are constantly changing in your cellular environment. And so we can create a lock which will never break, and that provides us with a new tool for targeting, which could be applied to drugs and other therapies, for example.
And in what way were the flesh-eating bacteria an inspiration, if you like, for this?
Well, this chemistry is actually very surprising, that no one thought this reaction would happen spontaneously. They're catalyzing something which would be very hard to do in a test tube. So learning from the chemistry that they're able to carry out and applying it in a new way, no one would have thought it would be possible until people started investigating the molecular details of how these bacteria function.
A way to subvert these killer bacteria by playing with their proteins. Mark Howarth lectures in biochemistry at Oxford and is a fellow of Worcester College, where Rupert Murdoch once studied and displayed portraits of Lenin. Back to Oxford in a minute, after we've heard from Aaron Yap, who's doing his PhD at the University of Western Australia, but already has published papers on RNA and DNA. Aaron.
Contrary to popular belief, molecular biology does not revolve around DNA. Sure, it plays an important role as the blueprint for life, but genes need to be copied into RNA, which is then made into proteins for living organisms to actually do anything. Using a musical analogy, DNA is like the original sheet music made by the composer. Like RNA, copies of the music are then made and transcribed into the different orchestral parts, such as wind or percussion. Musicians then interpret these copies to produce music or proteins. At each point, several levels of quality control need to occur to ensure proper production of the final product, making sure that Beethoven doesn't sound like Justin Bieber, if you will. My PhD is based on one of the quality control processes occurring in plant cells. This process, known as RNA editing, involves the modification of specific segments of these copies of the DNA by a superfamily of RNA-binding proteins known as PPR proteins. RNA editing mostly corrects errors present in the DNA, allowing the proper protein to be made by the plant. Each PPR protein specifically corrects a different error, and without them, a lot of plants would be dead. Through this specificity, we have managed to elucidate the molecular code by which these proteins recognize their RNA targets. This was done by aligning the protein sequence with the RNA targets and trying to find a best fit. It sounds simple, but this took hours of hand curation before a program could be developed and the process automated. The mechanism mimics the simplicity and predictability of the pairing between DNA strands described by Watson and Crick 60 years ago, but at a protein-RNA interface. At the molecular level, cells work in a similar fashion, and, as such, discoveries in one organism can be applicable across different species. If a gene is defective, its RNA copy and the proteins made from this will also be defective. This is the basis of many genetic disorders found in humans. RNA-binding PPR proteins could revolutionize the way we treat disease. Owing to their versatility, they can scavenge and bind a specific RNA molecule and have the capacity to correct it if it is defective, or even destroy it if it is detrimental. These can help ramp up production of proteins required for growth and development. These proteins could be a powerful tool in our future, not only for medical treatments, but also crop improvements. These are, after all, plant proteins. I was drawn to this project because of the possibility that it might lead to the ability to create a silver bullet to cure some sort of disease or improve the world in one way or another. And now it seems these possibilities may become reality.
Aaron, that was fascinating. There's only one major problem which I didn't understand. Who is Justin Bieber?
He's a very popular teen idol at the moment who produces some kind of pop music.
Right. I actually knew. I'm kidding. Yeah, because I understand he looks a bit like me. Is that right?
Yes, of course.
And what this talk came from, was it a 3-minute thesis that you did?
No, it wasn't. So it's basically a very brief look at what I'm currently doing in my PhD. And we've recently published this information, which can be found in an open access journal.
I see. But you do have these competitions, the 3-minute thesis, and even dancing your thesis on the University of Western Australia. How does that work?
I've not really participated in the dancing, but basically it's you somehow interpret your thesis with interpretive dance.
Doing RNA and DNA translation would be very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Imagine dancing your thesis. Yes, PhD students have lots of fun in Perth and turn out some brilliant science too. Aaron Yap is at the ARC Centre of Excellence, Plant Energy Biology of the University of Western Australia. And this is The Science Show on RN. I heard Sir Edward Heath conduct that exquisite serenade for strings by Elgar in July 1996 in Oxford. It was his 80th birthday concert, and the fun and the feasts were held at Balliol College, which turns 750 next year. And could it be that Doctor Who attended Balliol? We'll come to that. First, some history. You're about to meet Professor John Jones, Balliol's biographer.
My first contentious question, of course, is about age. And outside the college, it suggests that Balliol may be the oldest college. What's the truth of that?
Well, I have to give you a typically donnish answer. I mean, it rather depends what you mean and where you define the starting point for a college. There's a traditional pecking order, which you'll find in any Oxford University literature, which places University College as the oldest, Merton as the next, and Balliol as the third. However, University College only existed in theory until quite late in the 13th century. Merton College was itinerant around the 1260s, but Balliol has been here where we now sit for certain since 1263, and by the criterion of continuous existence on one site, which I'm sure as a member of the college you'll agree is a very good criterion, Balliol College is the oldest in the university and therefore probably the oldest in the English-speaking world.
I think we'll take that as a statement. And who was John Balliol himself?
John Balliol himself was a Norman baron. He was probably about as much French as English, in fact. He had lands in Picardy and all over England. He was the father of John Balliol, who was King of Scots. There's constant confusion about that. Legend has it that John Balliol, who had extensive estates around Durham, offended the Bishop of Durham to the extent that, by legend, he was whipped at the door of Durham Cathedral and made to found the college as a penance. Now, all of that is in a medieval chronicle, but medieval chronicles were the gutter press of their time.
Well, as you look around Balliol now, right on the Broad, in the middle of Oxford itself, with some wonderful quads and buildings, they don't look ancient. And of course, one of the problems with time as it passed is an awful lot of people didn't have necessarily the view of heritage, but said, that's a bloody horrible old building, let's knock it down and do a new one.
There are none of the original buildings surviving. The oldest buildings are themselves greatly changed, but are the library and bits and pieces scattered around the place. I don't think any of the old buildings were ever destroyed by insensitive vandals. They probably just fell down.
When it comes to the people, of course, an awful lot of tradition comes from the people who are here. The Australian associations are reasonably strong. There's one with the science unit of the ABC itself, Peter Pockley, but there's also Kim Beazley, our present ambassador in Washington, and of course Neville Shute, the novelist. Any other ones occur to you?
Hugh Cairns, Oxford medic, essentially the inventor of the modern crash helmet. He was a fellow of the college. Sir Peter Morris, who's still alive.
The surgeon.
Ex-president of the Royal College of Surgeons. Mike McKellar.
Indeed, became an MP.
Yes. I mean, he was exactly the same year as me, and I played rugby with him.
And the reputation of Balliol is very interesting because it seems to be almost willfully trying to be out of step with the main trends. And sometimes when you think it's left-wing, for instance, one of the masters, who is in fact a communist, and that's not terribly long ago, to slightly more conservative ones, for instance, associate with Adam Smith, you can actually say that capitalism was invented in this very college some time ago.
Indeed. Adam Smith was certainly here, and we're very proud of that.
But he hated the place.
It's an unfortunate fact. I was going to go on to say that we know very little about what he actually did here, and what he thought about the place is based entirely on letters to his mother, in which he said that he didn't feel very welcome. I think that what the college did for Adam Smith was simply give him the time to do what he liked. I don't think it did him any harm.
But when it comes to being willfully contrarian, is that reputation deserved?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the college over the centuries has had an awful lot of independent-minded people thinking for themselves, not really willing to conform. And in fact, one can see that long before what you'd call modern times. in the period just after the Reformation, the college sailed very dangerously close to the wind in sticking to the Catholic Church when that was politically uncomfortable. And at least three members of the college were executed. A bit later on, the college was far more royalist than was comfortable in the Civil War. And immediately the king fell and Cromwell's people took Oxford over. The fellows of the college, to a man, were ejected. They got their own back in the end by clearing off to the country, keeping quiet, and just coming back at the Restoration.
As for prime ministers, we've got Harold Macmillan, Asquith. He wasn't a prime minister, but probably should have been. Roy Jenkins, who left the Labour Party. And you've got kings from Norway.
Yes.
And what about the scientists?
The scientists who come to my mind, of course, obviously we have the Nobel Prize winners. But Hinchelwood is probably not a terribly well-known name. He was here in the early 20th century. I suppose the most famous scientist of all that we've had was Barry Blumberg, who was master from 1989 to 1994. He had previously been a student here.
And of course he worked on the Australian antigen.
And indeed, I have recently arranged for a memorial to be put up in our chapel with the final epitaph. He was a visionary master, and millions have been saved from hepatitis B through his work, which is true.
And he worked on, is this right, the Australian antigen. He went to Western Australia and got lots of blood from a number of people, Aboriginal people in particular.
His early work was studying the variation in blood samples from all over the world, in fact. I mean, he was a great traveller as a young man. Not only Australia, he collected samples from remote Inuit tribes as well, and Asian locations. But it was spotted that there was an antigen to hepatitis B in a sample which had been obtained in Australia. Hence, Australia antigen eventually led to the development of a vaccine.
He's one of the nicest men I've ever met.
Absolutely, and devastatingly fit in his old age too. Now, he was a remarkable man.
Well, the anniversary is coming up, 2013. How are you going to celebrate?
Well, there are going to be a series of special master's seminars, and they are going to take place in Brussels, Hong Kong, Sydney, San Francisco, New York, and Toronto. They'll all, except one, be chaired by the present master, that's Sir Drummond Bone, but the Sydney one is going to be chaired by the last master, Andrew Graham. There are also going to be at least one very special concert. Balliol has a long-standing, very musical reputation.
In fact, one old member whom I didn't mention in the list of prime ministers, Sir Edward Heath, he was a conductor of the orchestra.
He was, and not only that, he was the college's chapel organ scholar. So it's going to be that. And then around the 27th and 28th of September, there's going to be an enormous gathering of old members. The college is going to effectively take over the Sheldonian Theatre. There's going to be a very large dinner, and there's going to be an exhibition, which I'm going to curate in our new archive centre at St Cross Church, every century of the college's history.
Sometimes it is said that Balliol men, it used to be, but now men and women, are effortlessly superior. Are they?
Well, that's a tag which has dogged the college ever since Asquith said it. I don't think it's ever been effortless, but I think there's a certain amount of superiority.
Serenade for Strings was conducted by Sir Edward Heath in Oxford in 1996. And that was Professor John Jones, Balliol's historian, looking forward to the celebrations next year of the college's 750th birthday. And though old, perhaps the oldest, Balliol did establish the world's first internet institute in the late 1990s. Which brings us, of course, to Doctor Who. Where did he become a doctor? And when? He is, as you know, over 900 years old, so it must have been early on. He was a teenager for some decades, but must have gone to college about 700 years ago, and obviously didn't do a PhD because that's too recent, and German. Well, we've had a breakthrough in the form of an old fellow of the college, Dr. Melvin Schmendrick, who knew people, who knew people, who knew who. The details are enthralling, and I must warn you that Dr. Schmendrick is a philosopher.
I was there at the same time as him, but he wasn't there at the same time as I was. So whilst we were co-located, we were intertemporally different.
Yeah, I can understand that. What was he like as a student? Did he, you know, have lots of ale and screwing around?
Well, he was more of a screwdriver. He was interested in the motivation behind screwing, and he developed a device with a flat head which helped others screw differently, except if their name was Philip, and then he developed a special Philip's head screwdriver.
And what about his clothing? Did he have a long scarf? Did he have bow ties? What sort of thing?
He was flamboyant. It's as though he was already born with a doctorate. He had the appropriate garb, the floppy hat rather than the mortarboard, and the gown and the scarves. Sometimes they got caught up in his bicycle, which of course had no gears in those days. He really seemed to have lots of fun. He was adored, mostly.
Now, he was doing a doctorate. The problem is that the doctorate, the PhD, wasn't invented till something like the 19th century or 20th century in Germany. So what kind of doctor do you think he actually became? Because he couldn't possibly be a German PhD, surely.
No, it's kind of a bit downmarket to have been a medical doctor. So I think he was not so much of honoris causa, but he was a whole level above being a master. Because, you know, at Oxford and lesser institutions such as Cambridge, you do gain a master's degree just by living a year or two after your baccalaureate. So it was kind of a sense of status, elevation, superiority, just natural recognition of his...
That's right. First degrees, bachelor degrees were interchangeable with doctorates. You could actually call yourself one or the other. But Cambridge wasn't around then when he was there at Oxford, was he?
No. There was only Oxford.
And Balliol.
Balliol, yeah. And some of the lesser colleges, because it's hard to be the first college unless there are others to compare you with.
Talking about lesser colleges, Trinity next door, clearly when it was established, was a base for Daleks.
Definitely. The students were automatons, robotic, mechanical, but a useful juxtaposition by which one could compare one's humanity.
St. John's also. Tony Blair was at St. John's and clearly a Dalek, although Robert Harris in his novel thought he was a CIA agent. But, you know, it comes to the same thing, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. The ghost in the machine. One is the same and the same is one. I think there's some truth in the sense in which he was merely an actor, saying lines that either he had written before circumstances arose to justify them or those lines were written by others.
Do you think it's important that a prime minister from Australia should have gone to Oxford like Gorton and Bob Hawke?
Well, one out of two is not bad in terms of success. I won't tell you which one I think was a success. It doesn't hurt to be out of oneself. I note that Mr. Abbott and that other chap whom he kind of supplanted indirectly, Turnbull, they had some experience. At least they could learn some elocution along the way, some incidental benefit.
Well, Tony Abbott was at the Queen's College. He went to the same college as Mr. Bean, the engineer. Interesting enough.
Yes.
And Tony Abbott's been somewhat sort of robotic recently, which indicates that, do you think he might have become a Dalek in the process?
I think so. This whole exercise with driving the truck from one capital city to another, I think
those hard hats all the time serves not to show the antennae, you mean?
Yes, and the orange safety vest. Yeah, he doesn't want to get electrocuted by himself.
Do you think Julia Gillard would have benefited from a real education going to Oxford, maybe even to the Queen's College, where Welsh people are preferred?
I think so, and would have helped with linguistics and with feeling at home in foreign affairs generally, I think.
And none of that robotic voice.
I don't really think her voice is that robotic. Many robots are programmed for mellifluous behaviour.
A final question on the evidence. What convinces you, apart from the fact that you've spoken to people and you've seen him there, that
doctor who actually went to Balliol?
Well, as I say, you have relationships with real people and they have relationships with others, and therefore you trust that just by one degree of separation, the reality does take place. And it would seem to me that if we had no evidence, by which I mean that what was implied could not be inferred, and vice versa, then the whole scientific method would fall to pieces. So based as it is on a reality being a sense of shared subjectivity as something that is tantamount to the facsimile of the verisimilitude of objectivity, we must know, therefore, and it only follows ipso facto to be true, that he was there and that he arrived with a doctorate and left with one. Therefore, he was unchanged by the experience, and that is the ultimate proof of an Oxford education.
Do you mean that Doctor Who was, as the Balliol tradition requires, effortlessly superior?
Yes, he felt at home there, as many of us do, and I think that that is the test of whether one should be there or not in the first place. Tell me, Doctor, were you there?
I was there, yes.
Yes. But Doctor Who earned his doctorate, so we know then that Doctor Who's doctorate was not in Greek, was not in Latin, was not in the languages, was not in the sciences, including medicine, was not in the histories. I think that his doctorate must have been in an area that has yet to be discovered. So he came with that doctorate, he came with that knowledge, planted that knowledge amongst the peers he had at Balliol, and therefore their superiority was earned in borrowings from the future.
Thank you for being so solipsistic, Dr. Shmendrick.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have been here. And might I say, I've listened to many of your programs even before you recorded them.
Dr. Melvin Shmendrick, Fellow of Balliol College for the past 500 years. A college attended, you'll know, also by Captain Hook. Doctor Who, by 2013, will have been on television for 50 years, and he stars at the Sydney Opera House this week, the Doctor Who Symphonic Spectacular from tonight. And so to the Infinite Monkey Cage.
Welcome to Series 6 of the Infinite Monkey Cage. For those who have only just joined us, the story so far. Episode 6, The Empiricist Strikes Back.
After a ruthless battle, the Earth has been removed from the centre of the solar system and been replaced by the Sun. After an apocryphal incident on a big tower, it appeared that all objects fall at the same rate in a gravitational field.
Actually, Einstein showed that all objects are simply following geodesics in curved space-time, so really I would argue that they're all in inertial frames.
Yes, fair enough. Meanwhile, people were furious after light was shed on human origins.
Although light behaves in some ways like a particle, in some ways like a wave. Try explaining diffraction, for example, using a particle framework. Actually, you can with Feynman's sum over history's approach to quantum theory.
Yes, the life was more of a metaphor, really, there. At the close of the last episode, something was going on somewhere in Switzerland where there was a tantalising glimpse of a particle that might give us mass.
2.8 sigma isn't a tantalising glimpse. It's a precisely defined confidence level.
Yeah, tantalising glimpse is a little bit more charming, isn't it? There you go. Oh, I saw a tantalising glimpse of a lady the other day at the bar. Oh, my Constance. Oh, man, your science takes the poetry, doesn't it? Knowing stuff.
This is the Infinite Monkey Cage. I'm Brian Cox, and since I was last on air, I've been filming Wonders of Life for BBC Two, and in doing so, I've discovered that biology is a science.
I'm Robin Ince, and in the last week, I made a trombonist play jazz to earthworms in memory of Charles Darwin. And genuinely true. And they didn't like it. It was very free jazz, overly free for the earthworm.
Yes, the Infinite Monkey Cage madness about to reach you on RN. I shall introduce 6 episodes starting on Sunday, the 23rd next week at 9 a.m. with Brian Cox and friends. So, Brian, what is the Infinite Monkey Cage?
I think it sounds like an odd thing to do. It's really, I think, personality driven. It's the fact that there are a lot of comedians in Britain who have an interest in science. Dara O'Brien, for example, who I co-present programmes with, has a degree in physics. from Dublin, that Robin Ince, who I co-present Monkey Cage with, is an avid reader of science. If you ask him, what date did Richard Feynman say this, then he'll know, right? So it was the idea was to have a relatively light-hearted but often deep as well discussion about particular scientific issues. So usually it's a panel show. We usually have two scientists and one comedian guest, and then there's myself and Robin. And we just talk, and actually we record it in front of a live audience, and usually it goes on for about 2 hours, and then the poor editor has to sit there and edit it down to 30 minutes. So what you hear is a snapshot of this rambling, formless discussion around... We did one called, for example, provocatively called Is Cosmology a Science, for example, where we're talking about cosmology and the data. And so that's basically the format.
And how do you respond? Because you're not a stand-up comedian. I mean, your background's in music, if anything, yeah. In the public sense. Do you feel obliged to keep saying jokes?
No, it's not my job. And we always tell the scientists this, that the scientist's job, so my job and the scientist's job is to talk about the science. And then Robin's job and the comedian's job is to respond. But actually, you find that often it isn't supposed to be funny. It can be funny, but often you find that the comedian guest will have some interest and will end up interviewing the scientist. So we have no structure in the program. It's just everybody sits there and talks about whatever they'd like to talk about. And an example, just recently we had Patrick Stewart, the John Captain Picard from Star Trek, came on to talk about manned space flight. So he wasn't being a comedian, although he was quite funny actually, because he started talking about his experiences when exploring planets and things, you know. And he was talking to Monica Grady, who's a professor at the Open University, who's been very heavily involved in robotic space exploration. And so he ended up interviewing her, and myself and Robin didn't really do anything. And that's the point.
As we both know, that's the way that real scientists actually talk, because they're not being po-faced and stiff and formal all the time.
Yeah.
Talking in Martian. What they do is joke about their ideas. So it's not in any way reducing the ideas or the moral impact, dumbing down, in other words.
You've hit on an interesting question, actually, because when you popularise science, as you know, there will be people who say, well, it's too important to be treated in that way. Actually, I think it's the reverse. Science is too important not to be part of popular culture. As Carl Sagan always emphasised, it is absolutely the foundation of our society. We live in scientific societies. So to have a society where science is somehow divorced from the rest of culture, it seems to me to be, well, I mean, Sagan again emphasized, it's almost anti-democratic. It is anti-democratic because you have people who live in democracies whose lives are controlled by scientific decisions. If they know nothing about the science, then there's a democratic deficit, and you have problems because society can make decisions that are not based on reason. And
one thinks of the last American election. I mean, science was almost invisible.
Yeah, although Obama did make a very clear statement about climate change in his victory speech, which I thought was very important at the end. But it shows you, and that's because you have a society where there are many people who don't understand that science is not a belief system and it's not a point of view, that the scientists are not an interest group. I mean, they politically maybe they can be when they're lobbying for funding, but essentially science is a process. It's actually the process by which we understand how nature works. So if you want to ask a question about, is it true that putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere heats the climate, there is only one way to find out. It's to get data, build models, and try and understand the data. There is no other way. You can't sit there and say, well, I'd rather it wasn't, because that would be unfortunate, have tax implications. That's contentless. So I think that's the point about, I feel quite strongly that it jostles for position. You know, we work in the media as well as being scientists. And you've got reality TV shows and Dancing with the Stars or whatever. And science has to compete in that arena for attention, particularly amongst children. You've got to inspire them. They're also inspired by pop music and they're inspired by sports. They need to be inspired by science.
Sure.
So I think it's important.
We talk about public response. I know that there are several groups who've taken science on the road. A member of my family, Ben Goldacre, with Simon
myself
Singh
and Robin,
and yourself. And you feel stadia, like, you know, the old days of rock stars, feeling rock stadia. How do you account for the fact that science is so popular in the public area in Britain these days, like that?
There's a widespread acceptance of what I just said, that I think the scientific community now supports this idea that science has to be part of culture. So a lot of scientists will engage. And what we do with Ben and Simon and myself and Robin is we provide, it's almost like a variety show. So these live shows are not just us, they're local scientists come on as well. But you're right, they're 3,500-seater, 4,000-seater auditoriums.
It's incredible.
We actually did Glastonbury and 8,000 people came to a recording of the Monkey Cage. It's a radio
4 programme with 8,000 people. But and Ben said to me, actually, Ben Goldacre, he was actually talking about publication bias in drug trials, right, which is not the sort of rock and roll thing to do. But he got so, the audience and him got so excited that it was almost like Aerosmith or something. It was almost like a rock star going, and you know what? You see, there's a bias here. Only positive trials are published and negative trials are suppressed. And they're like, yeah! You know, so there's an atmosphere. And I think what it is, really, I think, is people respond to ideas. And what we're really doing is giving a snapshot of ideas to the audience. And because we make it move fast, so it's not an hour-long lecture, it's people giving 10-minute slots of snapshots. It can be publication bias, it can be cosmology, it can be whatever. And then there's some comedians there as well, science-based comedy. And so that's what I think people respond to, because it's stimulating. So I'm not surprised. I know that people are interested in science. If I go to a pub now, because I'm on TV in Britain, then I get asked a lot of questions about black holes and cosmology and particle physics, because people are naturally interested. Yeah. So I think it's not surprising, actually.
Brian Cox on Infinite Monkey Cage on RN from next Sunday. That's the 23rd of December for 6 weeks at 9 a.m, which brings me to a final topic for this week, one you've been worrying about all year, whether you should have sex with your cousin, particularly in Brazil. This is Alan Bittles in Perth.
The story in Brazil is that in the late 19th century, there was an uprising. Brazil had just changed from being a part of the empire to an independent country, a republic. And as part of the changes that were announced, the government decided they would bring in the metric system, they would bring in things like censuses, they would bring in a change in currency. And this was described by a lone preacher in the state of Bahia, Antonio Conselheiro, as a sign of the end of the world. It was the work of Satan. And so Antonio Conselheiro was traveling around inland Bahia with a range of his disciples at that stage, who were increasing in number. The local landlords became a bit worried about this because they saw themselves as being threatened by these, in many ways, vagrants who were going around the state. And so they asked the local authorities to sort this out. The local authorities sent in a police detachment, who were massacred. They sent in a small detachment of the army. They were massacred. They sent in a third, larger one. They didn't do very well and retired very much hurt. And so they had to send in a very large army to really put this insurrection, it was now a major insurrection, down. And this all occurred in a region known as Monte Santo. And Monte Santo is the area in which my colleague, Dr. Angelino Costa, and myself are working in the state of Bahia in Brazil.
And she invited you to work with her. How come?
Angelino very kindly wrote to me in April of this year and said she'd like to come and work with me because she'd read my work on cousin marriage and she thought this would be an interesting collaboration.
Isn't it a very brave thing to do, to go to a place where there's been so much killing?
I don't know that it's going to be all that difficult, particularly since I come from Belfast, so I'm inured to that sort of thing.
I see. Now, what was the novel written to celebrate that story?
This whole story was written up by the Nobel Prize winning Mario Vargas Llosa, and it's called The War of the End of the World. And it's actually very much a factual account with a few added individuals to add colour to the story.
And so here you've got this amazing place. What's it got to do with cousins?
Because it's fairly remote, the total municipality has got a population of 54,000. So many of the villages, people marry within the village, and of course in many of the villages, people marry within the family. So it's probably about 50% first or second cousin marriage.
And so what are you looking for? Strange diseases that erupt?
In this particular instance, yes. Because of the insurrection that set up in the late 19th century, people flocked in from all over Brazil and some of the neighbouring countries. And many of these people came to the religious leader, in part, I think, to be cured. So they came with their pre-existing diseases, I suspect, and some of them were genetic in origin. And so in Monte Santo, we find that, for example, there's a mucopolysaccharidosis is type 6, a very rare disease, which in Europe would be 1 in 45,000 to 1 in a million people are affected. In Monte Santo, with 50,000 inhabitants, there are 9 living people, another 4 people who have just died with this disorder, and a further 33 people who have died with this disease in the last 10-20 years.
Of course, the idea is that if you have a duplication of the genetic inheritance, and in other words, you've got 2 doses
of something that leads to susceptibility for a disease, then you luck out.
That's exactly it. And it's known as, really, the whole idea is founder effect. Someone brought the gene in, the mutant gene in, or there was a mutation in the gene in an individual. If you've just got a single copy of the gene, it doesn't have any adverse health effect. If you've got the double copy of the gene, then you will be affected with it. And the children who are born to parents who are cousins, or indeed to anyone, even unrelated people, but who nonetheless carry single copies of the same gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance each and every conception is going to be affected.
Incidentally, what does this tell you about the royal families of Europe, about which there's been a certain amount of discussion of inbreeding and so on?
There certainly is evidence that within the royal families there has been some adverse effect of inbreeding, in particularly the Spanish Habsburgs, Charles II, who died intestate at an early age, allegedly with a number of genetic diseases, fairly rare, in fact very rare, but extremely deleterious genetic diseases.
Well, haemophilia, the fact that the blood doesn't clot, is the most famous one, isn't it?
I think that's a misinterpretation, because of course haemophilia is an X-linked recessive, so if your mother has the gene for that, it doesn't matter who she marries or who she mates with, there is going to be a chance that you are going to be affected.
I see. Going back to Brazil, what sort of investigation have you done so far? Because you're about to publish, aren't you?
We've just sent off the first couple of papers on this, and indeed what we're trying to do with the particular disorder, MPS6, is to find out who exactly within this population is carrying the mutant gene. And to do that, you've got to do neonatal screening. So when children are born, you're looking to see whether they've got they're absolutely normal for this particular condition, or whether they've got a single copy of the mutant gene or a double copy of the mutant gene. What you then can do if they've a double copy of the mutant gene is actually bring in enzyme replacement therapy. And as of last year, a clinic was set up in the local hospital in Monte Santo to enable people to be treated by enzyme replacement therapy in Monte Santo itself. Previously, they had to go to Salvador, the state capital, which is about 350 kilometres away, and they would have to go there weekly throughout their lives.
In general, do you think it's still wise to avoid marrying and having children with your cousins?
I think it's been grossly overstated. This is one particular example of an isolated community that drew the short straw with regard to this particular disorder and a couple of other disorders. In general terms, the adverse effects have been overstated. The recent work that we would do would suggest that if you marry your cousin, you are more likely to have an infant death. 11 per thousand are going to be affected by comparison with the general population. Now, in countries like Pakistan, 68 per thousand of children currently die in the first year of life. So really, it's just been overstated. Now, I think often people said, oh, there's something wrong with this child, and oh, well, easy to explain because the parents are cousins. And of course, it may have been nothing to do with a genetic disease. It may have been a transplacental infection, like toxoplasmosis, or it could have been rubella, or even syphilis, which is still quite common in many third world countries.
Of course, one wonders what it was like in the old days, say 20, 30,000 years ago, when there were fewer people around and you were in bands of 20 or 30. The inbreeding must have been intense.
That's very much the line I would take as well. And in fact, the Art of Africa hypothesis, it's not just a hypothesis now, I think it's given as fact. Some people say that as few as 700 adults left Africa, and of course they didn't leave Africa in one big happy bunch singing along as they went, but rather in small family groupings. And I think the impact of disease, of attacks from animals, from trying to keep body and soul together would have meant that you mated opportunistically. And even if your daughter, your cousin, your aunt, whomsoever was available and of breeding age, then probably you would have gone for that individual.
Not only did you not know about genetics, you didn't necessarily know where babies come from either.
I think they had a fair idea where they emanated from, but how they got there in the first instance, I think that was the major problem.
Final question. You've read Loess's book?
I have indeed, yes. It's a very, very good book.
You'd recommend it?
I'd recommend it, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Professor Alan Bittles in Comparative Genomics at Murdoch University in Perth. Next week, The Science Show asks, what did Henry Sutton do in Ballarat in 1885? Production today by David Fisher and David Lawford and Doctor Who. I'm Robin Williams.